Welcome to the AMATS Citizens Involvement Committee meeting. We do have a review of what was discussed at the last meeting. Just to remind everyone that it was, we talked a lot about the Akron Interbelt project and about ideas that potentially, you know, would improve that area, especially after the Interbelt is removed. Also, just from an AMATS perspective, we did cancel our meetings that were scheduled for July. So we don't really have a whole lot to report. Mostly there wasn't much for the agenda to get the policy committee and TAC committee together. But obviously with CIC, we still cover a couple of issues that aren't necessarily exactly related to what we're doing on the mail out. With that, we kind of want to jump into our discussion. Well, first of all, I guess before we get started, I'll just introduce ourselves or go around the room. I'm Curtis Baker with AMATS.
Chris DeBeniston with AMATS.
Heather Reidel with AMATS.
Judy Bizzolt with AMATS.
Todd Chamberlain, Office of Student Services at University of Akron.
Reverend Ron Schultz, Family of Faith United Methodist Church, but I'm here on behalf of Neighborhood Network of University Park.
Good to see you again. I didn't recognize you without your glasses.
Yeah.
Well, Matthew retired.
And Jason Segedy, I'm with AMATS, and we hope to have a couple more people come so we're not outnumbering. Thank you for coming.
Well, I think what we're going to do is get started with the summary of the North Hill Better Block, and Krista will discuss that. I don't know if I'm in anybody's way.
Our mouse disappeared.
I see
it. It was up one second ago.
Yeah, it's there, but it's
not on our screen.
Have him never set it up.
Set it again.
Yeah. It's really weird.
Start hitting the buttons back there.
All right, well, good evening. I was going to do just kind of a quick recap. We talked, I believe, two meetings ago about Better Block, which is an event that we helped initially bring to Akron and sponsor. So kind of what happened with it and what are the next steps that AMATS and the city and everyone is looking at. So like the previous slide, the event was May 15th and May 17th, it was over 3 days. It was on the corner of North Main Street and East Cuyahoga Falls. And the Knight Foundation was a big part in helping, they provided the funding. So what Better Block is, this is a picture of the event, and I realized as I was looking at this, now it looks like a great place. I should have shot the picture before. If you can picture it with four lanes of traffic and cars parked on either side, absolutely no bike lanes, none of the trees, none of the plants, none of the people, pretty much just a speed through way is how it was. And so what Better Block is it's a program that's being kind of debuted all around the country, is it's a temporary way to show people what kind of a vibrant block could look like. So a way, instead of planning for 2 years and trying to get funding for 5 years and say, let's do this, we'll do temporary permits, let's just do it kind of as quickly as we can with what materials and what people and volunteers, and let's just try it for a weekend, see how people like it, get momentum, see what works, see what doesn't. It's kind of an easy way to test things quickly and cheaply, and then you also fail quickly and cheaply. So this is just an overview of the site. You can kind of see there's a lot of different things going on. One of the main things, and that we also were a big proponent of, was a road diet, which we took the lanes and made it two lanes each way. We added the bike lane and then also extended the sidewalks. AMATS came out with a road diet report a couple months ago, which is looking at all over the area of Summit and Portage County of roads that could be shrunk to accommodate other modes of traffic. So here's one thing that it did. It did reduce traffic speeds. We did count, I believe, from 29 miles an hour to about 15. So, you know, kind of it's all trade-offs. It was made for a much safer pedestrian environment. People could easily cross the street. Cars were slower. They were looking at what was going on. And then we had all of this activity. So as you can see, that bike lane is made out of chalk paint and duct tape. Curtis was one of our premier people measuring and putting down parking spots out of duct tape, and they looked amazingly official for that. So, I mean, you can see there's people using it, there's people on the sidewalks, there's things to do. Unfortunately, that does wear off in the rain pretty quickly, so you can see it started to fade. But some of the other things we did was narrow the road. We had the bike lanes. We added additional street trees. You can see a bocce court on the top left, some seating. Summit Cycling Center did a bike rental that was throughout the entire thing. And then there were just amenities on the bottom right. I think there was a storyteller. So there's all these kids on the street listening to stories and just a lot of interaction and people that you don't typically have. There, one of the big parts of Better Block is to have economic development. So there's a lot of businesses where they try to do pop-up businesses and give them a chance. So these are just two of the businesses that were doing food. Some of them were inside buildings. Some of them were just on the street. We did a mid-block crossing, and that is mainly just big sheets of kind of sticky tape that's down, that's just plopped down. You can see on the left some of our AMATS people hard at work. They made pallet furniture or pallet walls to make a beer garden. So just a lot of temporary things to help get people on the street. I think it was successful beyond all things that we could have anticipated. This was a cement lot, which had nothing between. It used to be a vacant lot, and then kind of two lots where one was grass and one was just asphalt, adding straw bales and mulch and flowers and having a stage and just having the area programmed. And then the city also helped do an open streets, which is another program that's, I know Madison, Wisconsin has done it quite a bit, and I think other areas of the country, where they close off a section of the street, I think anywhere from kind of 3 to 7 miles. And a lot of times, you know, it could be a weekday morning, or a weekend morning, excuse me. And essentially just letting people do whatever they want. So Better Block was at the north end and then all the way through downtown. There was a food truck station in the middle, which is the bottom right. I think that was pretty popular. The north end where the Better Block was, we had all the performances were out in the street. People could rent bikes. They rode all up and downtown. Picture on the top right is over the Y Bridge. So just experiencing the streets and the city in different ways that you typically couldn't. So hopefully the city, and we'll push for that, we'll continue to do these. I think that was a pretty successful event on everyone's part. It was fun. It was neat. You know, zero cost, essentially a little bit of organizing it, but overall a neat way. Another thing we've already heard several people talk about is other locations and other things to do. We had put together, and it's on our website, when we first were looking at picking North Hill, looking at all these criteria of things that made for good locations, kind of looking at those old bones of areas where they had potentially old corner stores on streetcar stops that were primed for infill development and areas that had been kind of disinvested in but could use some additional attention with a Better Block type event. So we have all sorts of other locations around Akron, and that also gives, I think, a lot of good criteria for other places in our area, too. One of the other big things that came out of this is we're helping to work with the city to make the road diet hopefully permanent. They were talking about doing it temporary, you know, for like 120 days. Or the other idea was to just, you know, if you're going to spend that much money to make it semi-permanent, just go ahead and do it. So I think they're still looking at that. And as I'm sure you're aware, there's been some election or mayoral changes which have thrown a wrench in things. But so the top is, sorry, these are maybe hard to see, but just kind of a streetscape of what it did look like with all cars. And the bottom is one potential with, you know, there is, it's a huge right of way. So if you added bike lanes and trees, you could still have plenty of room for everyone. And this is just a picture of kind of the whole streetscape of the narrowing it and where we're just starting to add amenities. I think overall the event was a huge success and everyone was really happy. there's been a huge response from the neighbors about just how much they loved it, how it created a place. All the businesses, I think a lot of them had pretty fledgling, a lot of them were saying they had record sales, and they're in talks about how they could potentially become permanent. There was a local kind of foundation that was helping to finance startups locally, so they've been working with that. And as far as safety and traffic, it definitely slowed traffic and was safer to cross the street. It did slow traffic, so you know, I think it's a trade-off if we want a vibrant place versus cars to fly through there. But overall, we had, you know, a very successful and fun 3 days, so that's kind of just a quick recap. I'd be happy to answer any questions or if anyone else has any other comments that attended.
Krista, I might just add a couple things. Great overview. What really excites us about the concept, and Krista addressed this a little bit, was we like the idea of piloting these at further locations. So last week, Curtis and I were out. We talked to the mayor of Cuyahoga Falls about maybe their potential to do this in Cuyahoga Falls. So even though that map was of Akron, although there are plenty of opportunities to do this in Akron, we think it's something that could be replicated really across our whole region. And like Krista said, it's cheap and easy to implement. So that's one of the things that we really like. You know, we kind of were fond of saying, as we were telling people what it was, worst case scenario, you get a really great street party for a weekend, you know, and best case scenario, it can really get some legs and turn into not only transportation improvements, but some chances to revitalize the neighborhood. And we really think that's good for a number of reasons that I think we'll get into a little bit more on the next presentation. Just a couple of takeaways real quickly. What we learned from it was it really is a project where collaboration really, people say collaboration a lot, but it really did take a lot of collaboration. And what we loved is, as public officials, we were able to be catalysts, but we weren't necessarily running the project. And I think that was important for us to learn in this community, that sometimes people tend to have a very top-down view of how these things should happen. And we liked that, you know, we in the city of Akron and other public officials could be catalysts and help, but that it really was run and organized and executed by volunteers, especially people from the neighborhood. And I think that was another really important thing, is that even though a lot of the slides you're seeing are physical infrastructure, it really was people and about people, and it was connecting people. And I think on North Hill now, there are all sorts of people who know each other that didn't know each other before. And the landlord that offered his space for pop-up businesses, he knows prospective tenants and so forth. So there were a lot of good, productive relationships that come out of it. And I think the final takeaway, especially for us at a planning agency, was so often, especially in urban planning, there's a lot of discussion about plans and about what we hope to do. But with this project, what was really great is we actually got to do it. So it wasn't, we're big believers in planning as planners, obviously, but plans are only as good as your ability to execute them. And although this was a temporary project, kind of what it leaves people with, Krista kind of alluded to this, is it all goes away, and it's kind of sad. You know, it's, you go back to the way the street looked, and in a way that's a good thing, because I think it gives people a little bit of a hunger for what this street could look like long term. And even if ultimately it looks a little different than this, we think that North Main Street will continue to redevelop, and this project will be a good catalyst to help it, and we're excited to try to pilot it other places in the region. So I won't belabor it anymore. But yeah, any questions, comments from any of you folks, or anything that you would like to find out more about, feel free to let us know.
Which website did she say the possible locations or potential locations?
AMAT's website, which is amatsplanning.org, and I believe it is, there's a Better Block tab under planning.
Okay.
But it can make sure
on
we
the
get
planning
that to
page
you.
Under planning, there's a section called initiatives. You'll see a button that says Better Block, and we've got a bunch of information there.
Okay.
And then the just betterblock.com is the main website for the company, or the people that kind of have put this on nationally, and they've got a lot of information on just other projects they've done, how-tos, some cost and budgeting type things, too.
Yeah, we've done some retrospect work about what we learned from this, what worked, what didn't work. We're also partnering with some other people from the neighborhood. They're doing a retrospect as well, so we're going to populate that page with more and more information, and we'd like to have it out there as a resource. If somebody wants to do one, they can download it, and hopefully it will help them.
I grew up not far from that intersection as a kid, and I attended the event. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've watched that area over the years with, you know, a saddened heart, kind of. So for me, it was exciting to see that. It did offer some hope and just a breath of fresh air. And I am, you know, I thought it was great. I thought you guys did an excellent job putting it on, putting it together, the way it was organized and that. And, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, something comes from it. I really do. That was great.
Great.
Cool. Thank you. Yeah, keep checking all those websites. Hopefully we'll keep collecting pictures and get more information.
Sneak by you.
I love this.
Yeah, and, Kyle, if you want, I can make some opening comments before you're getting everything
set up. It'll be fine.
Yeah, this item was on the vacant and abandoned property inventory that was done for the city of Akron by the Western Reserve Land Conservancy Thriving Communities Institute. And, while they're getting set up, I just wanted to make a couple framing comments, I guess. One, a little bit about just why it was done, but maybe even more importantly, why we're talking about it here at an AMATS meeting. So, you know, in the city of Akron specifically, this is true a little bit in the region, but especially in the city of Akron, we've had a lot of decline of neighborhoods. There have been a lot of good things going on, too. But I think the challenge that we face as a community right now is we've done a lot of things to make Akron a good place to work, you know, with projects like retaining the Goodyear headquarters. We've done a lot of things to make Akron a good place to be entertained, like Canal Park and a lot of the new stuff downtown. But the one thing that I think we've struggled with as a community, and this is not anything unique to us, this is really throughout the Great Lakes region, is we've struggled to reinvent Akron as a place to live. And so even though we've got a lot of great things going on, especially downtown, we're continuing to lose people. So just a couple quick numbers. In 1960, we had 290,000 people. Now we have about 199,000. So we've lost about a third of our population since 1960. And what's made that trend a little bit more worrisome is for most of that time, we lost about 75,000 people and actually lost no households. And the reason that's even mathematically possible is because households are getting smaller, and that's a trend across the whole United States. So up until about the year 2000, even though we kept losing people, we weren't necessarily losing households. Families were getting smaller. You know, there are more people living longer by themselves, less people having kids. People get divorced, and one household becomes two. There's all those social trends that, long story short, they kept our houses full. So even though we had less people living in each house, the houses were still really as full as they were back in the 60s. Well, since then, we've really started to run out of marketable housing. Now, of course, it's very easy to sell a house in the city of Akron, especially in better neighborhoods. But essentially, what we end up doing is playing musical chairs with those houses, and then the neighborhoods that are declining more, those houses disappear off the market. And I don't want to steal Kyle's thunder, but our trend has been we've been tearing down way more houses than we're able to rebuild. And so why is that important, or why are we talking about it here? And then I'll turn things over to Kyle. I mean, there are a couple practical real-world things. When you lose a third of your population, you have a lot of underutilized infrastructure. So speaking about at a transportation planning agency's meeting like tonight, You know, we feel like if there are ways to revitalize the city that lets us get more, you know, more use of the transportation system that taxpayers have already spent millions of dollars to build. You can see that with the road diets. You know, one reason why we're able to recommend road diets is because these roads are underutilized. We also kind of see transportation as an opportunity. If we can improve the way streets look and feel and people can relate to them, whether they're a driver, a cyclist, or a pedestrian, we feel like that's a very important tool in the toolbox of revitalizing neighborhoods. Not that transportation is by any means the only thing that makes a better neighborhood, but it is a tool in the toolbox. And I think, you know, the other practical reality is this is more on the fiscal bottom line. As the city loses people, we have the same amount of stuff, if you will, to take care of, same amount of roads, same amount of city to be policed and fire protected, less people to pay for it with taxes. On people's day-to-day life, as neighborhoods get disinvested in, you've got you know, less opportunities to shop, to work in your neighborhood, which means you have to travel farther. And the final thing that I always like to remind people of, and this is kind of how our whole region's interconnected, even though it would be easy to say, well, isn't this just a city of Akron problem, what the experience in Cuyahoga County, for example, has been with Cleveland and now a lot of the inner ring suburbs losing people is they've got such a bad vacant property problem in Cleveland that a lot of those properties are essentially worthless, and they're, you know, they're either making very little in tax revenue or the landlords are simply not paying the taxes. And so what that means is Cuyahoga County still needs the same amount of money to run its budget, and so consequently other people's taxes, mostly in the more affluent suburbs, go up. So that's just one example. There would be other examples, but of how a problem that might happen in one locality still affects other people. And I think the takeaway for us as a community, and why I'm really pleased that this report was done and really happy to have Kyle here to talk about it, is we don't want to get to the point, hopefully, that they're at in Cleveland or some of the cities that have even had more profound problems with this issue. And we're kind of hoping we can address the problems we have now and turn this into a positive thing. And with that, on the note of turning it into a positive thing, I'll turn it over to Kyle.
A lot of weight there. First of all, let me apologize to Jason and Krista and everyone else here for being a little bit late. I knew I was going to be late, so I ran home and grabbed my kids so everyone would feel sorry for me. But I do apologize for that. Hopefully the presentation will make up for that. And I'm going to talk about a report and a process that I actually wasn't involved in directly. I am the Director of Urban Planning for East Akron Neighborhood Development Corporation. I've been involved in that position just since the end of April. And so the process that we're going to talk about and EANDC's involvement in that, first thing you need to know about EANDC is that it's pronounced EANDC. That took me a long time. There's an orientation around the pronunciation of it. But the involvement of EANDC in this project was in 2014. But it's, as you'll see, I'm talking about other people's work at the beginning, and then I'll segue into how that work carries over into the work that I'm trying to do now. So in 2014, the Thriving Communities Institute, which is a program operated by the Western Reserve Land Conservancy, a nonprofit organization that previous to the instigating or starting up the Thriving Communities Institute, prior to that was really involved in preserving land, nature preserves, and establishing permanent open land spaces on the margins of urban areas. Some years ago, Jim Rakakis, a really innovative thinker on vacant property issues from Cleveland, took his knowledge and expertise to the Western Reserve Land Conservancy, and they started the Thriving Communities Institute to support principally land banking around the state of Ohio. And the Thriving Communities Institute approached the city of Akron, said, you know, we'd like to bring some of our capacity to help you out with your vacant property problems. And so they came up with the idea of doing an inventory of the properties in the city and figuring out a way to calculate, you know, the exact state of the housing and all the structures in the city. And the city and Thriving Communities engaged Yandice to be the contractor on the project. And so then we hired a team of surveyors who blanketed the city over the course of the late spring and summer 2014, and with carrying an iPad loaded with a special app that enabled them to access parcel maps and to categorize what was going on with each parcel in the city as they walked around, probably going through 30 pair of sneakers apiece. And so they asked questions about the parcels. First of all, is it got a structure on it, or is it a vacant parcel? If it doesn't have a parcel, is it a park, or is it a parking lot? Excuse me, it doesn't have a structure. If it does have a structure, what condition is that structure in? And so we see the categories for structures on the right there. So that was the process, a pretty simple process. You blanket the city, look at everything, and figure it all out, and then download the data. The data was manipulated by the wizards, and became a report on the state of Akron's property, land use, and the structures that are on that land. Again, using those categories, determining if there was no structure on the lot, on the parcels, and was it a park, was it a parking lot, or was it formerly occupied, or formerly had a structure on it, and now it's vacant. And then for the occupied structures, they were graded, you know, how solid is the structure, what sorts of features, again, based on that categorization in the previous slide. And also for the vacant structures that are secure, those that are boarded up, and those that are open and unsecured. Obviously, the open vacant structures are going to have more a higher percentage of those structures are going to be in the lower category. So everything's given a grade A to F based on that. And so then the data is calculated, brought together, and after all this surveying, it was really several weeks of walking that made this happen, and tabulated and mapped. And so the results show, that map there is a really impossible to get anything from, which you see. The color coding of all the parcels according to that key on the right there. And so then we see that the property survey breaks down like this in last year, with 74% the parcels having an occupied structure, and vacant lots are 18% of the land use of the parcels. And that's by parcel, not by area. Okay, so it doesn't take into account really big parcels versus really small parcels. And so the data was further broken down. I guess this is a tabulated version of the same thing at the top, but that's the raw numbers. And then here down here by land use. And so, again, it's just... The data was presented. I think it gets really interesting when we start to think about the tabulation of the data by neighborhood. And here we're getting closer to, I think, you know, tying into some of the things that were going on in the earlier talk. So, for example, North Hill, where the Better Block was, we have 5% of vacant structures were secure, and probably not none, but less than 1% were vacant structures that were open. But 12% of the lots in North Hill are vacant, which suggests, you know, a lot of opportunities there. 12% is, you know, one out of every eight lots, I think that's right, is poised for infill development or poised to become a receptacle for somebody's used tires. You know, which way is it going to go, right? And then these are arrayed based on descending order from the first column. Occupied structures. So, you know, Cascade Valley has 57% of the lots don't have a occupied structure on them. And the city, of course, is highlighted in bright yellow. So, you know, armed with this information, then you can make some judgments about the quality of neighborhoods, about which neighborhoods have really been slammed by foreclosure and vacancy. I think we can say that no neighborhood has escaped it. Although, Northwest Akron's 10% vacant lots, I think are probably, many of those lots are ones that never got built on. So it doesn't take that into account. Downtown Akron's 20% of parking lots. One out of every five parcels in downtown is a parking lot. So there's, you know, the data, once it's tabulated, once it's presented, helps you to make distinctions between the neighborhoods, helps you to think about, in a city-wide sense, where should resources be targeted, what sorts of neighborhood form. Krista talked about those neighborhoods with the old bones, and certainly Northwest Akron doesn't qualify as one of those neighborhoods, so we can sort of cross-reference these numbers with what we know about the neighborhood form in these areas and what we know about the demographics of them, and we can start to think about strategies for recovery, strategies for bouncing back. The report does take the information and array the neighborhoods based upon the concept of hotspots, where there are areas that either do or can anchor neighborhood vibrancy. And they qualify or define those hotspots as areas that are walkable, that are not car-centric. So these are those areas that are precisely where the old bones, the pre 1945 bones, are still very much in evidence. The not car-centric places where we have a clustering of neighborhood attraction and gathering spots, those third spaces where you can meet your friends or meet people you don't know. They're neither workspaces or home spaces. We have public assets, publicly paid for assets that are clustered, and where we have a diversity of population in every sense, ethnically, age, income, a diversity of property values, and a diversity of tenure models, ownership versus rental. Based on those characteristics and based upon the array of the vacancy problem, the authors of the report, gave us these four categories of neighborhood hotspots, excluding downtown, excluding the university area, because those are special cases. And we have one established hotspot in the city of Akron. I think that probably rings true for most folks that know the city, in Highland Square. And then they further categorized our neighborhoods based upon the categories of potential and emerging hotspots, struggling hotspots, and then there's those neighborhoods without potential hotspots. And here's where the transportation piece comes in that Jason just mentioned, almost entirely those neighborhoods without potential hotspots those that never really had those bones, or they built in a completely different way. They started out with the four-lane or even five-lane or really big roads, so they were car-centric from the very beginning. I quibble with the inclusion of Middlebury and at least the core of East Akron in that category. But there's definitely a relationship between where the hotspots are and then how transportation infrastructure was put in place and then how it's erased over time or built up over time. Now, what I'm going to transition to now is to talk about actually putting this information to use, which is where I move into my current work now. And this map here is taken from the data that was tabulated by the survey team in 2014. I should say that in addition to the report, the data was also presented in an online dynamic map format, a searchable, you know, just like Google Maps. The only problem with that is that it's password protected and not public facing, and I don't know the logic to that. I can't speak to that. I have access. So this is a screenshot from that map. That is the core service area for the Yandese, this East Akron. North-south north-south street in the very center is South Arlington, and you can see I-76 there. And then this most furthest south east-west street is Archwood. And then Kelly to Inman Street, and that large brown semi-triangular shape just south of I-76 is Hoban High School, if that helps to orient you. This is the core service area that we serve at Yandese, and where we are devoting a lot of time to thinking through this problem about vacancy and deteriorating properties, and then what happens, how to devote resources to dismantling, demoing the deteriorating properties, and then what happens next? Okay, what happens next? Because this is a neighborhood that was very hard hit by the foreclosure, very hard hit, and then we've had money flood into the state through the hardest hit settlement and other venues, other avenues, and the pace of demolition has really picked up, and that's a good thing. But then what we haven't really had, either at the neighborhood level or on a citywide level, is really strategies for figuring out what's next. Okay, and we're in a situation in East Akron where we have a housing market that really does not support any new investment without significant subsidy. So we're left with a situation where we need to figure out what we're going to do with that, the vacant land that's left behind. And what we decided to do, again, this is prior to my work, I'm speaking in the kind of global we that doesn't quite include me yet. In 2013, Yandese engaged the Cleveland Urban Design Collaborative, which is affiliated with Kent State's architecture school, to really think through this problem of what to do with vacant land in a neighborhood that's not going to, whose housing market is not going to bounce back anytime soon. And if you're not familiar with the CUDC, they are really amazing thinkers about urban design, and they have, they're really on the cutting edge of developing practices to deal with this stuff, and they're nationally recognized for that. And we are really, lucky to have been able to bring them to us. And so, if I look at this map that I showed you previous, and here's again the key, so you can sort of think, the blue is various shades of occupied structures. But if I control for occupied structures and I'm just concerned with vacancy, I'm just concerned with vacant lots or vacant structures that are either secure or not secure, then, you take away all the good, right, and you just think about the problems, we have a lot of work to do. I mean, the color is, it maybe washes out a bit too much, but the tan is all the vacant lots. This is a neighborhood as I said, really been hard hit by this problem. And so what we've done is to think about ways, using the CUDC plan as a starting point, a launching point, and engaging our neighbors through community organizing in different community engagement strategies. What can we do with the land that's left behind in the wake of foreclosure? What can we do, in the best case scenario, if nothing is done that's creative, we have a mowed lawn, But in the worst case scenario, you know, we have a very different situation and situations that breed crime, okay? What we've done is to look at ways in which those vacant properties can become neighborhood assets. And these are projects that were completed this spring just as I came on board. They were initiated by my predecessor, Chris Norman, and who's since moved over to the zoo. We had a demo property at the corner of 5th Avenue and Hart Street, right where you get off the freeway, I-76 for the Arlington exit. That was, you know, high grass and unmanaged and had a dead car sitting on it, and we turned it into a gateway park. Okay, so now you get off the park and or get off the freeway and you know where you are. Okay, and then one of the things we're going to do to add to this moving forward is we're going to put a pole on there with some signage that's going to direct people to Hoban. It's going to direct people to Arlington Church of God and other anchors in our neighborhood. So then it's, again, from my sort of asset. And then up here, another strategy that the CDC folks identified for us was to look for ways in which you can find mid-block vacant lots and use those as opportunities to, if you can have back-to-back ones, to create pedestrian connections. This is the before and after picture, okay? And what you see is on the back side of this block is a small playground, Homestead Park. It's been there since the 70s. But when this house was taken down in the late 90s and the vegetation had grown up, it became a dangerous place that children didn't want to go to, that parents didn't want to go to, that the people who lived next door didn't want to go to. And so we opened it up, obviously, and we put that pathway in it. This picture was taken in early May, so the landscaping hasn't taken off yet, but it's much better than that now, and I'm waiting for a contractor to install a bench right here at the curve. And the other important thing, so now we have children are able to get to the park in a pedestrian-only environment. But the other important thing, and probably the best outcome here, is the fact that the street lights on Homestead, which is on the other side of the park, and the street light on Hart Street, which is where I'm standing when I take this picture, the light that they cast now meets. So there's no danger zone anymore. Okay? So these are the kind of strategies that we're implementing using the CUDC plan as a guide. And here's another example of how I'm using that vacant vacant land report, that map, as a way to think about it, because when you look for clusters of vacant properties, I'm sorry, Jason, I'll give you just a second. You look for the clusters of vacant properties, and you start to think about adjacency, and you think about land assembly just the way a developer would. And so what we're going to do is use those two properties that I've circled there to create a neighborhood pathway that's going to connect Duane Avenue to Fifth Avenue, and save the children walking to school about 1,600 feet of walking and give them, you know, that safe path right to the front door of Robinson Elementary School. Jason, sorry.
Oh, no, that's just a quick question. The walking path that was already installed, it connects Hart. What's the other street?
Homestead. Homestead is behind the park where these houses, the white houses, sit on Homestead, and this is Hart. Yeah. And so, and you know, it's really been great to drive by there this summer because there's a lot of kids playing, little kids in the playground, and you have big kids playing in the street, bigger kids, but good. These guys play in the street, I don't mind. The other thing I'll say about Homestead Park is that on August 15th, 13th, 14th, 15th, we're going to replace the playground equipment. We're going to have a neighborhood volunteer day, we purchased new playground equipment with some funds from the Ohio Community Corporation for Housing. So we're going to replace that with some help from John Valley, the city. So this really become, a project that both rescued a dead space, but also rescued a, made that park really come alive again. But I want to transition here and talk about some two recent projects that we did with neighborhood volunteers, and also as a way of thinking about some of the limitations of the data that was collected. These are two lots that sit kitty-corner to each other on the northeast and southwest side of the intersection of Chittenden and McKinley Streets, which is two blocks east of Arlington, just a little bit behind the Arlington Church of God. And as you can see, they're unattractive. They're eyesores. And this one on the top, is the northeast corner, had really been a problem that the neighbors had brought to us in our community meetings, and a couple people in particular would always complain about this one. And you know, the mothers walking their children in strollers would have to go out into the street because the kids were getting with the weeds and things like that. There were tires and broken bottles, all sorts of stuff. And so, so we went to work with the neighbors, and we cleaned them out. And you know, I think we did good. This was accomplished in one day with a crew of about 35 folks, and a lot of bottled water, and you know, the Keep Akron Beautiful trailer. We broke a mower, but it's not Central Park, but it's also not a danger spot anymore, and we did what we could. Yeah, any question?
Yeah, Kyle. How are those going to be maintained? Has the neighborhood stepped up?
Not the way I had hoped yet. I'm working on that piece of it. I've engaged a mower to take care of this, the one where we planted the flowers. But you know, I'm working on that piece. That's a piece. You know, one of the things about East Akron is it's an older neighborhood demographically. I don't mean the houses. I mean the people. It skews older. So the folks who are most concerned about the appearance of the neighborhood are also the ones who I really can't ask to get out with their mower, you know. So we're working on that. I do have some connections to some younger folks who I have already sort of stepped up to do some of this work, and I'm trying to, you know, see how I can sort of channel that in support of some of this recapture work that we're doing. So yeah, we mowed it out. We did a street edge garden there. The flowers just taken off. They look great. And that fence, you know, that was about $35 in lumber and $50 in ground screws. So, you know, talk about your lighter, quicker, cheaper, right? I mean, we did this whole thing. You know, the Keep Akron Beautiful Trail is free, but we did the whole thing. The most expensive piece was the T-shirts. Not counting the T-shirts, it was about $250, and the neighbors love it. I brought this up not to just brag, but to think about the limits of the property survey, because what the property survey tells us is that these are vacant lots. Okay. Well, what I wanted to know is, well, what can we do with those? And so I wanted, okay, let's find property owner. Let's ask somebody, you know, do you mind if we do a planting and things like that? Well, this lot is owned by a shell corporation in Southern California. Yeah. I'm not even going to bother. They have a P.O. box, you know. So, and this lot, the one over here where we planted the flowers, the official tax mailing address of record is that lot.
Huh.
Yeah. So, you know, and then I've been looking around, and there are a number of these zombie lots in my service area where there literally is no record. And so, on the one hand, when we did this, we were trespassing. On the other hand, you know, if the foreclosure, if the, you know, financialization of housing that produced the foreclosure crisis is going to invent new and untenable forms of property that lead to this, then I'm not going to respect those forms of property, right? You know, I'm not going to wait around for the legal system to catch up to the needs of the neighborhood. But that's the kind of stuff that that is not joined to the data in our inventory report. Okay, so we have condition of property and we have vacancy, but what's separated from there is how the property got vacant and who's not holding up their responsibilities to their neighbors. And what we really, really need is a way to put those two pieces together. Some things to think about in terms of the limits of the property survey. It's a static picture. Okay, it was created in 2014. It's difficult to update. And the data is proprietary. I already mentioned that. It's behind. The data itself is not accessible. The dynamic map is not public-facing. And then the data is not linked to property data or occupant tenure. So there are things that we don't know that we need to know. And this is called out by the authors of the report. We need to know about the concentrations of rental properties. And we need to know who the largest holders of those rental properties are and who are the owners of the vacant properties and where are those zombie properties. And we especially need to think about properties as they move through the foreclosure crisis and as they move through the tax lien process. The tax lien sale process, we have the land bank now, and with the land bank, properties that are delinquent on their property taxes above a certain level, they can be foreclosed upon, and a lien placed upon those properties for the taxes, and that lien can be sold as a tax certificate. And the buyer of that certificate buys a bundle of properties together, and after a certain amount of time, they can foreclose on that property. But in the meantime, they can charge 18% interest per year. What we're finding is that in Akron, Summit County, and all over Ohio, there's one company that tends to buy tax lien certificates, group of companies. And they're an out-of-state conglomerate. But they're not holding the properties. They're only interested in the debt. And then they're spinning off the property. There are several properties in my service area that have gone through the tax lien sale process that are now owned by a company in Alabama, the same company. And so, this is the kind of chain of title that we want to, and we want to go backwards the other way, too. Some of these have been foreclosed on two or three times, as I look through the chain. So, how do we connect the current condition with the future disposition with the past history of bad lending? Okay, so now there is one model that's available to us, and I would try to open this dynamically, and I can't because of the Wi-Fi situation, but there's a website. I encourage you all to go here. It's called makeloveland.com. makeloveland.com, and this is a group of young techie wizards out of Detroit. They actually came to Akron to speak about 6 years ago. I took these guys. They have this dynamic mapping system that allows you to immediately access parcel level data on properties in several cities, and they started in Detroit, but they've expanded to about a dozen cities, I think. You can zoom all the way down in at the street level, at the parcel level on this. It's a dynamic map. It's just like Google Maps. And these are the layers that are available to you, okay? Ownership, occupied, tax foreclosure, tax auctions for various years, the land use and the zoning, the property tax assessments, the building age, all of this stuff is demolitions from federal funds, federally owned land. This is the kind of stuff that we could really make use of in thinking about, how to react to the problem of vacant properties, both in terms of strategies for dealing with vacant land, dealing with deteriorating buildings, but also at the policy level, so we don't get hit upside the head again.
On some of these lands where you have a pedestrian walkway,
yeah.
You mentioned that you want to have the lights or everything. If you put a trees on them, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Because then I'm thinking maybe it makes hiding places for bad people. But then I heard everybody towards trees.
Yeah, I mean, you always, it depends on the type of tree, you know, and it depends on the placement. If there's anything else, you know, you don't want, you gotta be careful how you landscape, and then you want to make sure that, you know, you don't have those kind of bushy, weedy trees. You want to have a true tree.
Right.
So you know, we're trying to be careful with that and look for the right types of plantings, and that's why, you know, we were toying around with different models for that little fence thing that we did, you know, just to try and dress it up. And you know, once the lumber dries out, it's pressure treated. Once it dries out, we might go back and paint it with a nice design. But there's only three slats.
Right.
We didn't want to create, you know, you hide behind that, I'll see your legs.
Right.
You know, we thought about that, right? So, you know, we're always conscious of that.
Another thing, again, these things where you don't know who the owner is, these zombie slots, is there anything you can do that would force the owner to take legal action, which would cause them to reveal who they are?
You can never...
like squatting or...
Yeah, you know. I mean, you can't force somebody to step forward.
Okay.
Because if they don't want to, they're not going to. Okay. You know, and it really depends on what your goal is.
Okay.
If there's a building there, and the building is, you know, is a nuisance, okay? There is a provision under Ohio law that I think we ought to bring into the policy discussion here in Akron, where you know, code enforcement only goes so far because people don't respond to code enforcement. You know, they don't respond to the tickets. They don't care. But there is a provision under Ohio law with residential structures only, where you actually can, if you're a municipal government, a neighbor within, I think it's 500 feet, or a community development corporation, you actually can engage in a legal process that you go to a judge and you say, this is a nuisance property, here's our plan to fix the nuisance property. Okay, we're going to renovate it or we're going to tear it down. Okay, it's going to cost X. We have X and we want to do it. And it's a nuisance property. And the judge will say, okay. And anybody who has an interest in that property has to come forward and give a reason why it won't happen. Or it can happen. And once it does happen, then that the expense of fixing the property becomes a lien, a primary lien on the property, and then you can foreclose on that lien.
Okay.
Okay? Which is a lot quicker than a lot of the ways in which, you know, it can be like a 6-month process instead of a 3-year process. You're actually suing the building and not the owner.
Okay.
So everybody who has an interest in it gets a notice.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that's a strategy. It doesn't work for vacant properties, though. And also doesn't work for commercial properties.
Okay.
So, you said the out-of-state corporations snatch up these lien sales.
Yeah.
So here you are, let's say you're tearing down a building, the judge says, go ahead, now you've got a lien against the property, and you're going to buy the property because there's a tax lien on it? You tore the property down, tore the building down. You've got a clean on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
You spent money on it.
When you say me, I spend money on it. Who do you mean?
Well, you're East Jackson Corporation.
Oh, okay, okay, yeah. Well, we're not spending any significant money on any property we don't own. Okay, you know, $250 is about my limit.
It comes back to title, right? Who owns that plot of land? No matter what's on it, who owns the plot of land? But you're saying in some cases you can't find an owner of that plot.
Right, you definitely can't. You definitely can.
There are no City of Akron, Summit County rules that say if you haven't paid your taxes in 5 years, it goes to a land bank automatic. I don't care who you are.
It doesn't go automatically. It goes through that tax lien sale process.
But then somebody can buy that.
They can buy. They buy the tax certificate, and that allows them to sort of dun the owner and try and collect. If they don't collect, they can foreclose on the debt. Once they do that, this company that's buying these certificates, buys almost all of them, they don't care about the property. They care about the ability to collect on the debt. Once they do that, they're spinning off the properties to who knows who's interested in rental property. So what we've created here is a sort of county-sanctioned method of spinning our properties off into absentee owners.
Okay.
Well, if the property is spun off, presumably it's spun off in a way that is because it can be turned into an income property. That's one of those things that if we had the right, you know, the right setup, I would really like to track the disposition of properties that have gone through the tax lien process, because the way the county sets it up, they don't bundle good properties and sale a bundle. They'll bundle one good property with 10 dogs and offer that bundle for sale. What we need to know is what happens to those properties that are dogs, right? That's a really important question that I've only begun to explore, and it's very difficult. I've done some scripting that can sort of automatically loop through the county website, but it's kind of a dinosaur itself. So it's kind of hard to extract the right data from it.
I'm thinking of the homestead law. You got a blank piece of property with nothing on it, been abandoned. You're not getting any money for it. Nobody knows who it is.
Mm-hmm.
You let somebody move on it and make an improvement under the homestead law. Well, I think they rescinded that.
I think they did.
And now you made an improvement on a property,
yeah,
so now
yeah,
you own it. And well, I don't care who owned it before.
Well, I tell you something, that little garden, flower garden that we patch was the strongest expression of ownership in that property for about 15 years.
Mm-hmm. Can you give, it's a long word, would the city allow you to say, we're going to clip this vacant land, nobody knows who's owned it, we looked up the property records, no tax has been paid, can't determine who the legal owner is, call it abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
And for the good of the community, we're going to plant 4 almond trees on there, and all the neighbors can get the almond crop when they come out.
Yeah.
As long as they cut the grass every
mm-hmm.
summer.
Well.
Or turn it into
yeah.
a community garden.
And we've done some things to properties that we don't own. Again, I don't go through the city when I talk about that type of process. I don't want to be told no.
All right,
And it's just, when I find a property that's a zombie like that, we've done a handful, a few, I guess I would say even a handful of things, but we've done some improvements. And yeah, we're actually thinking about doing vegetables on one right now, in next year, because the owner just hasn't done anything. So, I don't think we really need to get titled. I don't care. No one else cares. Why should we? Why should we go to the trial?
With property, do you ever look at leasing the property to a neighboring owner or some kind of ownership with the land that has been banked?
Yeah, I mean, we have a couple property owners that have, with a couple instances. We have people who have just sort of flopped over the property line and taken over, and erected a shed and and they're mowing. And then we have people who just mow. They don't have any other sort of improvement, so to speak, to the property, but they're just mowing it. And then there are the side lot programs available where people can buy a vacant lot for $250, and we're trying to encourage people to do that too.
Does that seem to be very effective in this area, or is that?
I think that the one I really want to sort of quantify or figure out a way to recognize. We've just started a program to recognize our blight busters.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to find those people who are mowing the lawns that they don't own.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of hard to count.
And I think Curtis's question about the side lots or other strategies is, it kind of gets back to what you said at the beginning of the presentation, Kyle, that using this information and maybe subsequent information that's collected to develop a strategy citywide. Because when I think about vacant property in the city, we run the gamut from Rolling Acres Mall, it's a pretty darn big, which really has some of these same issues, with an absentee owner that will not be responsible. And there's been this constant drama with the sheriff sale and the auction and then coming forward at the last minute. And but everything from that to the smallest vacant lot in the city. And what I really love that EMC is doing, which I think is a great model, is we don't have a lot of unfortunately, a whole lot of organizations like ENC and Akron that can really delve down into the minutia of we're going to get 35 people together and fix up this lot for the day, but we also need, conversely, you know, more of a 30,000-foot view, because like when Kyle showed the slide with all the neighborhoods, you know, each neighborhood is very different, and I think that was a great point you made about diving into that data. Even that chart, as good as it is, it's not necessarily a rank order of the, you know, like I would say, just kind of from what I know about the neighborhoods, even, you know, Firestone Park may have a little bit more trouble than its number one ranking in that slide indicates. I think it's definitely still one of the stronger neighborhoods, whereas, you know, Wallhaven or, well, Northwest Akron is pretty high up there, but there may be other neighborhoods that vacancy number is, like you said, more because there's a decent amount of lots that have never been built upon. So it, I think being able to have one entity, you know, I think the city would be the entity to probably take the lead on that, to do some strategic comprehensive planning, but then have groups like yours and others really be able to get granular. And I guess this is more of my personal hope, but I hope it becomes a big issue in the election, you know, both in the council elections and in the mayoral election, because it is a challenge for the city. What are we going to, you know, right. When I talked to the planning department, the Abraham Westcott, who works on a lot of these issues, told me that we're averaging tearing down almost 500 houses every year, and which in a lot of ways is there are houses that need to be torn down, but we only build 10. It's not counting apartments, but like Kyle said, this is more, it's triage to tear these vacant houses down, but then we, you know, we need a plan for how are we going to, you know, stabilize neighborhoods, repopulate neighborhoods. Like you said, maybe East Akron isn't the one to start to build new housing in, or without subsidy at least.
Right.
But maybe we've got other neighborhoods like West Hill that are adjacent to good things going on, like at Highland Square, that a market could be stronger.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. And what we really need to, you know, what we, if you look at this map and you know, it's, we see pockets of vacancy here, there, and everywhere, and it's really hard to evaluate each one and think about it in terms of what the next disposition, you know, how to move forward. And there's a lot of risk in that inheres in all of that. But what we really need to foster, I think, is a system of distributed risk where we encourage small-scale developments that can take over 4 or 6 parcels and think about creative packaging. And if that happens in 20 places across the city at the same time, and you know, this is the same, what you're talking about with BetterPly, 5 of those fail, well, that's not a bad ratio, right? But let's not put all of our eggs in any one basket, because that's a strategy for failure. So we need to, whether it's nonprofit organization or small developers who can, you know, put some of their own skin in the game, we need to have development, encourage development that's responsive and flexible and that spreads risk around different neighborhoods and different entities. I think that's one of the, and that's, you know, I think that's one of the things that jumps out at me as well. There's pockets of land when I look at these maps. There's pockets of land that could easily be assembled. Unfortunately, almost all of it is zoned single family. But that's a story for, or a presentation for another day.
Yeah, another problem. I used to live there in the Yelf area uptown, and they were tearing down a lot of houses. We used to hear that either Summa Hospital or the university was buying up all the property just so that maybe 20 years from now they'll be able to put a hospital there.
Right.
In the interim, is there anything that can be done with the vacant lots?
Well, yeah, there's always interim strategies for land maintenance and land disposition, thinking about, you know, if, especially if you have a good sense of what your time frame is. If you have a 20-year window, you know, you put in a blueberry patch. All right, but if it's a 4-year window, then, you know, something else comes in. Or you know, you have a planning department that, that makes our anchor institutions think about their interface with the neighborhood that surrounds them. I mean, that's the other strategies. Maybe, you know, wide-scale urban urban clearance isn't a good way to be a neighbor.
Yeah, could we, I mean, could we get SUNY or the University of Irvine buying up to do something or to maintain it in the interim or instead of
right.
just letting go to see?
Yeah, oh, no, they definitely should need to think about their edges. And that's a critical part. You know, we're thinking about, you know, what's going to happen with the Interbelt. You know, that's got to be a piece of that as well.
Just this is kind of related in a way to what Gene asked. You mentioned it a little bit earlier. Where are we, your take, with the land bank? I know it's kind of, until recently, it was still kind of just getting up and running. But
they've definitely got programming going on.
Great.
They're a conduit. I think the best thing that they've done right now in the last, I would say, 18 months or maybe even 2 years is be a conduit for money, which, you know, is great because the city's really put that to use. They've given, we had a discretionary grant, $50,000 last year that we used to do, you know, tear down, I tore down a church last week because the city doesn't have the capacity to tear down non-residential structures. So we want to build a lot. I had to, you know, so those kind of things. They're channeling money to us that we've used. I used some of it for that Homestead Park, or Chris did rather, Homestead Park piece. So there's that piece of it. Now they're to the point where you can call them about properties that vacant land that's delinquent, you know, and that is about to go into that tax lien sale process, and they'll pull it back. And then offer it to you for $250, you know, for a residential parcel. So they've got that capacity. They've staffed up. I think they're what they consider fully staffed at 4 or 5 now. What the piece that we need to think about, or what I hope they're putting in place, is what to do with buildings. And you know, we need to be doing a better job of warehousing our buildings. I think that's, you know, and making distinctions about a demo process versus a where. You know, I was in, we were in Cincinnati last weekend on our way back home from vacation, and we stopped in the Over the Rhine neighborhood. And, you know, if you go by the number of buildings that are occupied in that neighborhood, it's a miserable percentage. But if you go by the number of buildings that are being allowed to deteriorate, they're doing awesome stuff because they've got the creative board up process. They've got an adopt-a-building process. They're working with small-scale developers, like I just said. You know, that's a different strategy.
I think I hear you saying there it sounds very smart. We might want to tear the buildings down that are truly beyond the point of no return or actually present a safety or health hazard
right.
in a big way. But just because something doesn't look real great, we need maybe more of a fine grain to look at it and make better decisions about what to save and what to mothball
right.
and what to
right.
tear down.
And can we invest a little bit of money in mothballing?
May I have
so that in 15 years a developer can say, you know what, yeah, let me work for that.
Please check out your material now.
I bought my house through the VA and found out that the minimum lot size is 50 feet across the front.
Oh, yeah.
So I wound up buying a 30, a 30, and a 40 and combine them into 100. I mean, rules change.
Right.
The way it was set up years ago, people lived in little houses on
yes.
little lots.
Yeah.
But now they don't want that. So when
yeah.
one house goes down, that's where the side lot comes in. A person can buy that next 30-foot lot. Now he's got a 60-foot lot, and he can offer
right.
maybe a structure under the VA system.
Right.
Can you... When we say these 30-foot wide lots aren't very big.
No, they're not, but I'm trying to look. I don't have a good example on that, which is granular enough. But you know, it's one of the things that we need to think about policy-wise as well, is because right now, in a lot of these neighborhoods where we have the single-family only zoning designation, what we're saying is you can only build a single-family house, but 15 to 20% of the lots in that neighborhood that is zoned only for single family are unbuildable,
right?
And especially because everything's got to have a garage now, and it can't be a detached garage in the back. It's got to be next, you know. So, you know, that adds to that. So, what we're really saying is we're committing ourselves to population loss. We're saying we're never going to build on those parcels, right? And so we need to change the policy. Either we can build on 35-foot frontage, or we can build on three parcels that are contiguous, but not build single family. Something's got to change, or we've just said population loss is what we're going to be. So,
I saw this miniature house from California. The guy built it on a small lot for $10,000. He could be a student.
Mm-hmm.
So he bought the lot, built it to code, whatever, you know, 10,000, narrow house, the top in the bathroom, the bedroom, and that's about it.
Yeah.
Maybe a sitting room. It's all in a row. Yeah. And of course, you don't worry about the snow up in California.
In Louisiana, they have shotgun houses.
Shotgun
that would be a pelican house, right?
Very interesting. Well, they're going to close a lot.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was a great presentation.
Very good.